Okay, so we're going to get started. You know, one thing when we talk about extremism, we need to think about good and hard. This applies to almost every synagogue I've ever been to, is that there's no such thing as low air conditioning. I don't know why that is the case. I always say, if you're going to put it on, please keep it small, but and I, whatever. It's we try our best, but I hope that you're dressed more warmly than you thought you needed to be, and everything will be good. So as I mentioned at the outset, my philosophy of the whole thing and what we do through the Institute is trying to bridge different groups through trying to present a bigger picture, which is what Judaism actually is, as opposed to the half-truths that very often are kicked around. So what I wanted to do in this talk is give an outline, basically, of different areas, both within Orthodoxy itself, between Orthodoxy and other Jewish groups, and then Jews and non-Jews, how just focusing on the what Torah is trying to teach in a bigger picture, we very often realize there's no reason for friction whatsoever, and then our job is just to go out into the world. That's what we do through the Institute, through our journal conversations, through our website, where we get a minimum of 10,000 hits per month, through programs all over the country, through teacher training, which I've been doing more and more, just going to teaching seminaries and also going to schools, trying to promote here's how these values can be implemented by teaching them to our students and why we can promote a greater vision out in the world. Within Orthodoxy itself, I wear different hats. One of them is that I teach Tanakh at Yeshiva University. I just completed my 41st semester this past week, which is crazy. And we have at least one person in the room who was with us for several of those semesters. It's one of the things that you find, I don't know where my students come from. I don't know what schools they've been to. I don't know where they're going afterwards. But I know that they've almost invariably, unless they went to Ramaz and had Miriam running the show, keeping things straight. But outside of that, I'm expecting certain fundamental fallacies in their Tanakh education that we just have to kind of undo. I even have a class at the beginning of every single semester, and if you're taking me multiple times, you have to put up with it multiple times per semester. I just go over, I say, here's 1 hour worth of what I wish somebody would have sat me down when I was 16 years old, and just said, here are the rules. Here's what you've been knocking yourself out to do since you were a little kid. Here are the rules. Here's what all of our commentators are doing all of the time. Here's how they do it. But nobody ever gave me that talk, so I had to spend years trying to figure out, well, what should that talk be? And then I just give it. One of the things that comes across loud and clear within the Orthodox world is there's a huge tension or rift with regard to how you view Midrash. Where certain students, from the time they're very little, learn Midrash folded into the text. And they never learn how to undo that. It's fine when you're 4 years old. It's even fine when you're six, on the grounds that their little kids give them a break. But still, the question is how it is presented, and then what should happen down the line. What we find is that some students, as a result, think the Midrash now is an essential part of our religious tradition, and violating that is a violation of religion. And then there's a second group which say, I just don't buy that. Right? They reach the point, whether they're 12 or 14 or 16 years old, whatever age, and they say, this doesn't make any sense to me at all. And if you raise your hand in class, the teacher may not realize how much he or she is going to shape the religious future of this kid. They try to shut down the questions that might inspire some. It might truly drive away others. The truth of the matter is this rift, which exists in the 21st century, existed in the 12th century too. And we hear poor Rambam lamenting it. Drives him up a wall. Right? He says, what's going on here? The sages were geniuses, but they didn't always teach mindless history. And so he breaks up the Jewish world into three categories, which honestly are the same three categories that they are today. But it is critical that we try to promote very actively and very regularly this third group. So I'll just read it to you just because you can never paraphrase Rambam's colorful and very emphatic language. He says, the first group is the largest one. They understand the teachings of the sages only in their literal sense, in spite of the fact that some of their teachings, when taken literally, seem so fantastic and irrational that if one were to repeat them literally, even to the uneducated, let alone sophisticated scholars, their amazement would prompt them to ask how anyone in the world could believe things true, much less edifying. The members of this group are poor in knowledge. One can only regret their folly. Their very effort of honor to exalt the sages in accordance with their own meager understanding actually humiliates them. As God lives, this group destroys the glory of the Torah of God. Say the opposite of what it intended. For he said in his perfect Torah, the nation is a wise and understanding people. God promotes the Torah. God is an excellent PR agent in his own Torah. And he says, if you do Torah right, everybody who sees advocates of the Torah will say, this is fantastic. I'm going to be inspired by that. You know, Miriam just spoke, Mrs. Berger just spoke about the messianic dream. One of the things that the prophets hoped is that if we get our own act in order, people will see our ideal model society and say, we are inspired. We want to also implement our societies to move in that direction. So Rambam says, if the advocates of our religion are coming around teaching things that are foolish, well, that isn't exactly going to inspire fellow Jews. It's not going to inspire anybody. And that's category one. So Rambam, he says, look, bless their piety that they respect our sages. That's good. That's the half-truth that they have. But the downside is they don't understand what our sages are trying to do, which is to show the wisdom of Torah. Moving on to the second category, they're even worse than the first. The second group is also a numerous one. It too consists of persons who, having read or heard the words of the sages, understand them according to their simple literal sense and believe that the sages... understand them according to their own simple literal sense and believe the sages intended nothing else than what may be learned from their literal interpretation. Inevitably, they ultimately declare the sages to be fools, hold them up to contempt, and slander what does not deserve to be slandered. In other words, they're like the first group. They take the words of the sages literally. The first group, therefore, dogmatically accepts all of them. And the second group says, well, if that's what the sages meant, this is ridiculous. I'm out of here. So Rambam says this members of this group are so pretentiously stupid that they can never attain genuine wisdom. This is an accursed group because they attempt to refute men of established greatness whose wisdom have been demonstrated to the competent men of science. So here are the two half-truths. Half-truth number one is we respect and venerate our sages. They're the representatives of our tradition. Half-truth number two, we respect science, logical thinking. We do. Okay. So Rambam is saying the problem with these two groups is that one half accepts just the sages part and they reject logic and science. The second group, because they believe in logic and science, reject the sages. And what's the full truth? Put them all together and what do you got? Rambam, who is a very lonely man. And he says there is a third group. Its members are so few in number that it is hardly appropriate to call them a group. This group consists of men whom the greatness of our sages is clear. First half truth, we know that the sages are good. They're brilliant. They represent our tradition. They know that the sages did not speak nonsense, and it is clear to them that the words of the sages contain both an obvious and a hidden meaning. Thus, whenever the sages spoke of things that seem impossible, they were employing the style of riddle and parable, which is the method of truly great thinkers. So Rambam says all you have to do is put the two half-truths together and you get Judaism, which is our sages are the paragons of truth. They are truth seekers. They are the bearers of our religion, but they don't always speak literally. And sometimes it is obvious that they are not speaking literally. If we can get that across to our students, we never for a second take away from the greatness of the sages, because that's not our goal. And at the same time, we never shut our brains off, which the sages certainly never wanted us to do that. And that's what Rambam is so frustrated by. So the same rift in the 12th century is the same rift that we have now. And it is a fixable rift. It's simply a matter of our schools, our teachers understanding this and passing that on to our students. It's hard work, but it's something that can be done. Another thing that I like to teach in just about every capacity where I go is I try to teach our Gedolim stories, where we try to venerate stories of our sages. And it happens that certain Gedolim stories don't always make it into Art Scroll. And these are the ones that I like. These are the ones that present a different face of Jewish teachings, where you actually get to the heart of what's really the debate, as opposed to just why this and that sage was saintly and fabulous and wonderful, which I'm sure they all were. But there's more to Judaism than just the saintly, fabulous, and wonderful. There's also an element of what are our core values? Here's a Gedolim story that you likely will not find in any Art Scroll publication. I don't mean to put Art Scroll down in particular. I just think that there's a sense of there are certain stories that need to be told. About Yosef ibn Achnin, for a while, people thought that this actually was the perplexed Rabbi Joseph that Rambam addressed his Guide to the Perplexed to. It turns out that it's not, but for a very long time, he was thought to be the target of Rambam's great work. Turns out it was a different Rabbi Joseph, but this Rabbi Joseph also lived in that time and was a huge fan of Rambam. And he wrote a commentary on the Song of Songs. And what he wants to do is justify the fact that he is going to quote non-Jewish thinkers in his work. So before going out and about with his commentary, he's going to say, this is what I'm going to do, but he can't just do that. He has to tell Gedolim stories to justify that great rabbis before me have done this. So here's his story. Rabbi Matzliach, source number two. Rabbi Matzliach ben Albatek, the rabbinic judge of Saklia, told Shmuel HaNagid when he came from Baghdad that one day in Rabbi Hai Gaon's yeshiva, they studied the verse, let my head not refuse such choice oil. They studied a verse in Psalms. That's already a chidush in certain yeshivot where Tanakh is not covered enough. But they were sitting around discussing the meaning of a particular verse in Psalms. Rabbi Hai Gaon was the great bearer of the Geonim. These were the Rashi Yeshiva in the Geonic period, who were the bearers of Talmudic tradition, the Babylonian Talmudic tradition. Rabbi Hai Gaon was one of the greatest. So one day they're all sitting around debating what the meaning of this verse was. And those present debated its meaning. Rabbi Hai of blessed memory told Rabbi Matzliach to go to the Catholic Patriarch and ask him what he knew about this verse. And this upset Rabbi Matzliach. He said, look, we're all stumped over here in the yeshiva. Why don't you go down the block to this Catholic Patriarch? He's an expert in Tanakh. Christians love the Psalms. Let's ask him what he thinks. So Rabbi Matzliach, you know, probably using some form of body language or horrified face, expressed his displeasure to the great Rabbi Hai Gaon, who was the leading rabbi of that generation. And Rabbi Hai Gaon saw that Rabbi Matzliach was upset. He rebuked him. Our saintly predecessors, who are our guides, referring to the sages of the Talmud, solicited information on language and interpretation from many religious communities, and even of shepherds, as is well known. What's your problem? This is what we do. We're seeking truth in our tradition, and we don't pretend to have the monopoly on that truth. Right? We believe in our revelation, we believe in Jewish tradition, but we understand that sometimes other scholars of other backgrounds have something to say to us, and it's our job to hear that. I like this Gedolim story, not just because of what Rav Hai Gaon says, but because there was a Rosh Kollel, this Rabbi Matzliach, who opposed that. Right? I like the fact that not all Jews thought this way. Here's a story from the 10th century, where there's two sides of the argument. One argument is we seek truth, and we're going to find that in any way that we can. There are scholars of all backgrounds who have contributed immensely to our knowledge and understanding of the world. And then there's the other side, which we have to remind our students and ourselves sometimes also, that there is a world of difference between scholarship and scholars. Scholarship, when pure, is always good in our tradition. We seek truth. All scholarship is valid, and if something is true, we accept it. And then, of course, every scholar has a bias, because we're human beings. Nobody's objective. Sometimes people pretend that they are. Don't trust them so much. Of any background, whether they're good Orthodox rabbis or whether they're secular, doesn't matter. Everybody has a bias. So what's wrong, and that's what Rav Hai Gaon said, is that we should never dismiss any scholarship. That's absolutely inappropriate in our tradition. But simultaneously, there needs to be a caution that scholars all come with biases. And it's important when studying the works of scholars to understand what are the underlying biases. Is this true scholarship? Or is there something that's not fully provable that somebody is bringing a bias to the table? This is another area where I think Jewish education dreadfully needs to have a clear sense of what we're trying to do, which is we're always looking for truth. We should never be afraid of ideas. It doesn't matter who says them. And simultaneously, to be cognizant of different biases. One of the most interesting Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals weekends that I did, I was at Cornell University as a scholar in residence a few years ago. And they wanted to have an Ask the Rabbi session on Friday night. So I said, you know, I don't know you, you don't know me. This is the first talk. So you might want me to give a presentation first so students get a little more comfortable. They said, no, ask the rabbi Friday night. That's the way we're going to do it. And you got to keep in mind, this was something that I learned only when I got there. This was up against a Cornell-Harvard hockey game. So odds were stacked against me. But despite all of this, Baruch Hashem, Cornell won. I just want to say I totally personalized that weekend when I was there. Some 50, 60 students showed up. And it was supposed to be an hour-long session, and then some people, I imagine, would go to the game. Some people would do whatever they do. That wasn't my concern. We stayed for about 3.5 to 4 hours, and nobody budged. And all they were doing was asking every single question that a thoughtful college student would have in matters religious. You know, the biology people were asking their evolution. The ancient Near Eastern people were doing what they were doing. Everybody, whatever your major was, you know, one philosophy major said, you know, this, just this week, my professor refuted God's existence. What am I going to do? I said, if he's a good professor, next week come back and he'll prove God's existence. And that's what a good philosophy teacher should do, right? Don't lose your faith over these sorts of things. But of course, that's what a good professor of philosophy should be doing. That's how he's doing his job. But what I found staggering was the need for Jewish high schools to train their students, since we're trying to get our kids to go to good colleges, to have some tools to use when they get there. And that's something that stories like this, I think, are actually very helpful. Stories like this that teach us the sense of we're never afraid of ideas. It doesn't matter what the bias of the person is. But just to be conscious of who we are and what we can learn and what the biases of the other people are, we can actually do a lot. So that sort of college weekend, I think, is something that I found very valuable overall. That's area number two, where you'll find rifts within the Jewish community over should we be borrowing ideas from other people. The answer is yes, but with certain cautions that were already anciently known cautions. So those are both within the Orthodox world. When it comes to Orthodox, non-Orthodox relations, there actually are two models. I'm a big chassid of Professor Menachem Kellner, who taught Jewish philosophy at University of Haifa for many, many years. We've become friends. He was a scholar in residence in New York a few years ago. And I said, I like this guy. I'm gonna become his buddy. So every year when I would go to Israel, I would always make a pilgrimage to Haifa and we'd take a walk on the promenade and just talk. You know, he's the Jewish philosophy man. I'm a Tanakh person, but I care a little bit about Jewish philosophy too. So I would just pick his brain on everything I could think of for that summer trip and then continue the conversation. He's written a couple of books which I think are really very important. One is Dogma in Medieval Jewish Thought, which is the more scholarly work, and then there's the more popular work where he comes up with provocative titles such as Must a Jew Believe Anything? I like that title very much, actually. My favorite title of any of his things is Would Maimonides Get Into Rambam's World to Come? He wrote an article on that once. I thought that was just a sensational title. And so he's really very good at coming up with stuff like that. But in the meantime, the gist of it is like this. In the Jewish world, there are models of what to do for believing Jews when we think about granting that an overwhelming majority of Jews don't currently believe in all of Jewish faith properly. Right? Most of them don't believe in Jewish faith properly because they simply never learned it. Right? That's the reality. So the question is, do we look at them as evil heretics or do we look at them as misguided? What's the proper approach for the faithful toward people who don't fully accept for any reason at all, whether they're struggling with things or whether they really have hostility toward it or in most cases just don't know? So as far as Rambam is concerned, you know, Rambam was the right side of the fence for the Midrash example. Here he actually comes out with a very harsh stance with regard to all Jews who don't fully believe in all of Jewish belief. Source number three over here. Rambam says, when a person affirms all of these principles and clarifies his faith in them, he becomes part of the Jewish people. In other words, from his point of view, Judaism is primarily a community of believers, right? It is a mitzvah to love him, have mercy on him, and show him all the love and brotherhood that God has instructed us to show our fellow Jews. Even if he has transgressed out of desire and the overpowering influence of his base nature, he will be punished accordingly, but he will have a share in the world to come. As far as Rambam is concerned, people sin, and God will still forgive that person. But if a person doesn't believe, one who denies any of these principles has excluded himself from the Jewish people and denied the essence of Judaism. He is called a heretic, an apikoros, one who has cut off the seedlings. It is a mitzvah to hate and destroy such a person. As it says, those who hate you, God, I shall hate. That's the same Rambam that we were just talking about before in a more tolerant sense. As far as Rambam is concerned, there is a severe problem with somebody who has his or her beliefs out of whack for any reason at all. As many scholars will point out, Rambam didn't see it as a sinful thing to get out of the world to come. Rambam saw it as kind of the equivalent of if you've never learned arithmetic and you apply to a doctoral program in advanced mathematics, you're not going to get in. It doesn't matter whether you were shooting spitballs in math class as a kid or whether you just weren't privileged to that education. You still won't get into the program. So the world to come is kind of like that. If you've prepared your soul accordingly, Rambam has very exacting standards of what that means, then you get in. And if you didn't, it doesn't matter why you didn't. Whether you're scornful, whether you just never were taught properly, whether you're making honest mistakes, goodbye. And that's Rambam's, it's a very dogmatic position. And many Jews in the world today take it. In fact, my father would argue in many of his writings, a growing number of believing Jews will take that sort of approach. A very exclusionary one where it's us and them. We're the believing community and everybody else is out. It's not just a matter of we have the truth. It's a matter of we have the truth and everybody else is bad. Right? Which is what Rambam is advocating for here. He says that's it. You're kind of excluding yourself from full peoplehood. And that's certainly how certain believing Jews today take that to be. But Professor Kellner points out in his writings, and I'm very grateful to him for finding all of this out, he says that Rambam's view is a tremendous minority in Jewish thought. The overwhelming majority of rabbinic thinkers in the medieval period didn't understand what Rambam was talking about. They said, wait a minute. It matters why you don't believe in something. If you've studied Jewish belief thoroughly, and you say, I reject this stuff, that's one thing. But if you just read the sources and you read them wrong, or if you never even were privy to the sources, how could you call somebody a heretic? The person's not a heretic. The person is simply mistaken. There's a world of difference. If you think 2 and 2 is 5, you're not a heretic. You're just not going to become a math major. Right? That's all that it is. You're wrong. And so it's the job of the believing communities, rabbis, educators, etc., to model and teach proper belief, but not to exclude those who currently don't believe. And this battle goes back to a classic source in number 4 over here. Rambam says that 5 categories of heretics are called minim. Rambam has a whole classification of different kinds of heretics. So these minim include one who says that there is no God, nor is there a spiritual ruler of the creation. So one who denies God, okay. One who accepts that the creation has spiritual rulers, but insists that there are 2 or more spiritual rulers. Okay, so basically the right number of gods is 1. If you think that there is more or less, you're out, right? Then you're certainly beyond the pale of Jewish belief. One who believes that there is only 1 God who rules nature, but he has a body and a likeness. Rambam includes in this category of heretic somebody who has the completely wrong, misguided sense of what this one God is. As far as Rambam is concerned, if God is a body, you can divide God up. God is not perfect anymore. Right? That's it. As far as Rambam is concerned, that's as bad as idolatry. So Rav Avad jumps in, Rambam's great critic, you know, contemporary critic, Rav Avraham ben David. He said, why did Rambam call such a person a heretic? Referring to the one where somebody believes that God has a body. Several greater and better rabbis than he thought that God does have a body and likeness, based on what they see in biblical verses, and even more so from rabbinic teachings that can confuse the thoughts. Rav Avad says, there are rabbis who think that God is a body. Rav Avad, by the way, believes those rabbis are wrong. He agrees with Rambam that God does not have a body. But he says that great rabbis thought this. Why did these great rabbis think this? Why do they think this? You open up a Tanakh and page after page, it never talks about God's incorporeality. God has a hand, God has fingers, God has nostrils that flare up when he's angry. Right? Not to mention he gets angry. All of these different things that Rambam dismisses as allegory, well, some rabbis might open up the same sacred texts and read them and say, I think that they're literal. And the same thing with the Talmud. There's all kinds of passages in the Talmud where, if you take them literally, God is quite, certainly has a body, God puts on tefillin. Right? And Rambam would say, you're A, an idiot if you think that these are literal, and B, you're a heretic. Right? Which is much worse than an idiot. Rav Avad's point of view is, okay, you might be foolishly reading the sources, but it's a genuine, sincere error. You're not trying to reject Judaism here. You're simply reading classical Jewish texts and misreading them. You can't call such a person a heretic. That's all he's saying here. He's saying you're allowed to say that these great rabbis are mistaken. But calling somebody mistaken and calling somebody a heretic are wildly different things in our tradition. So Rav Avad is the majority view, as Menachem Kellner demonstrates very thoroughly. Most Jewish thinkers believed, as Rav Avad does, that it's possible for people to make mistakes, and that doesn't make them heretics, as long as they're sincere. You're only a heretic if that's actually what you're trying to do, if you're trying to exclude yourself. Yeah.
Thank you. What is the children?
Now knowing that you got it wrong and getting it right. Right? In other words, if you're corrected and you're like, oh, now I understand, bing, problem solved. In other words, that's what they argue rabbis and teachers should be doing, making sure to teach properly. In other words, they understand that there are misguided people out there, just like today, and often just because out of sheer ignorance, they don't know. So our job isn't to condemn them and exclude them from the community. Our job is to teach them properly and include them in the community. So this is another model of where there are two models out there of how you deal with Jews who currently don't believe in something. One where you shut them out and denigrate them and hate them. And the other where we love them and try to teach them. Okay, so I happen to think that choice B is a better one. And not only do I think it's better, but this is the dominant voice within our tradition, and it's important for us to get that dominant voice out there, given that there are voices that, in this regard, they follow Rambam to the T, where they're excluding people who don't believe one way or the other. I'll give you another example within this. It's not just in terms of dogma and belief. It's in terms of what type of community model you have. The Sephardic world never had movements. Right, when modernity came in, the Sephardic world had plenty of people who were not keeping all the mitzvot. But the synagogues always remained what we call in today's language orthodox. They understood this is the right way to do it. This is the community, this is traditional Jewish belief. And we also understand that not all members are doing the right thing, but we're going to encourage them to belong and to do the right thing. Right? Whereas most of the Ashkenazic world fragmented into these movements, which is a talk about serious rifts that have harmed the Jewish people to no end over the past 200 years. So whenever I think about these two models, my first view is, what in the world, how do you get that one wrong? It's so obvious that it's better to hold everybody together, even if that means not everybody in the community is doing exactly the same thing. So Rabbi, besides the historical factors, which are important and obviously you can't turn back the clock on this, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has a wonderful book called Community of Faith, where he discusses this very issue. And he says, besides the historical issues of why there are movements, he said that there's modernity actually promotes something that we think of as authenticity. So what happens here? Let's say a Jew doesn't keep Shabbat. So why do you want to belong to a synagogue which says, we keep Shabbat, and we believe in the Torah, and this is what the Torah says, and all Jews have to do it? Why don't you just start a new synagogue where they say, you don't have to keep Shabbat? It's more consistent. And, yeah, it's true. Fine, but I'm saying there's a means of thinking about it this way, that in fact you're actually more consistent by creating a movement or creating communities or schools that promote the values of the people who actually go there. And the same thing on the critique on the right was, how can rabbis, it was a criticism of the rabbis and the community leadership, how can you welcome Jews who are violating the Torah? Yeah? In terms of, Your excellent point, and I think that there's some truth to that. To me, it's just about how do we view the Jewish community. Right? So the Sephardic or inclusive, by the way, KJ is an excellent model synagogue, an Ashkenazic synagogue that has it right. There's a very clear sense from within all ranks that everybody belongs here. Right? So it has it right. And Rabbi Jonathan Sacks talks about how his United Synagogue in England, when he was the chief rabbi, it also functioned that way. It's not just the Sephardic world. The Sephardic world totally adopted this model, and many model communities did the same thing, but many did not. Many said, quality, exactly your way of putting it. Let's form synagogues that are fully Orthodox. One of the interesting historical footnotes about New York City Jewry is that congregation Sherith Israel, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, was the only synagogue in New York City from 1654 till 1825. 171 years, with no breakaway synagogues. It's a small community, but all the same, that's still impressive, given that we tend to form breakaway synagogues even when there's not a lot of people. The second synagogue that was founded was B'nai Jeshurun, BJ, on the west side. I don't know where it was originally in 1825, but BJ. And the reason why they broke away is to create a more religious synagogue. They said that Spanish-Portuguese, most of the people are not observant. We're going to create a more observant synagogue over here, in addition to an Ashkenazic one. But actually, part of the motivation was greater observance. So part of the model is, let's create fully faithful communities and simply forget about the rest of the world. So Rabbi Sacks points out that's one of the reasons why you have fragmentations. And you go to Brooklyn. I was a scholar in residence in a synagogue in Brooklyn just last month. But it's like one of two synagogues, like, that I think of as synagogues. There's so many shtibels and yeshiva minyanim. There are very few actual synagogues that function as communities in that real sense. Because it's just so fragmented. And obviously, when it's so fragmented, What happens is you go to the place that either is the most homogeneous to you, or honestly, what I'm guessing without having polled everybody is the one that has the best cholent. Right? That's probably what really drives that sort of thing in a densely populated community. But either way, what ends up happening is, okay, it's very consistent, but it destroys the Jewish community. Right? So our model is the inclusive one, one where we say, we believe in modeling Torah, faithful Torah. It's the job of the leadership to be as inclusive as possible and never to shut anybody out. And simultaneously never to bend on what tradition really is, to say, this is what we represent, we all aspire to it, but we're all one Jewish people. We all belong together, even regardless of levels of observance. That's another layer of what we're trying to do. In the realm of Jews and non-Jews, the best example is the chosen people concept, which is one that I speak about a lot. Most of the times when I speak about it, I go to Orthodox synagogues and schools and talk about a topic that I think is critical for us to just address forthrightly. I think the most interesting place I ever spoke about the chosen people was a unique opportunity for me. It was at the NBA National Dinner in 2007. So I had to give an invocation at the NBA National Dinner. Don't ask me how I got roped into that one. And I don't even, forgetting about the NBA part, I don't even like giving... Hi. Excuse me. Worry not. It's just a happening place. But we're all good. We're keeping to our schedule, and then some happy child will have a birthday party in this very room. And so everything is cool. Yeah, so getting back to I don't like giving invocations. It just means getting up and giving 60 seconds of something that's kind of airy. So I told them I'll give an invocation on condition that I get up to 5 minutes. That's all I want, 5. So what do you talk about when you have 5 minutes at the NBA National Dinner? You talk about the chosen people. Now, at some point, I have to let you know that what we're talking here is the National Bible Association dinner. So I was not the shortest person in the room, but I was actually the only Jew in the room. Because there were only 5 other Jewish people who were a part of this thing, and they all came late. So it was actually, it's true. So it was me and hundreds of Bible-believing Christians, and I was talking to them about chosen people. Right? And that's what I wanted to talk about there. I wanted to let them know what chosen people means in Jewish tradition. And you should know, they all clapped, which is better than, you know, death silence that you really don't want to get after you speak. What it basically comes down to is that the Torah makes very clear that it has 2 layers of meaning which are both simultaneously true. One is that it's absolutely universalistic. The mission of the Torah belongs to humanity. There's one God who created everybody. Everybody's created in the image of God. We're all one family. There's absolutely no room whatsoever for racism. And I'm not speaking as a 21st century New Yorker who has to say the politically correct thing. When students of mine say anything that smacks remotely of racist conduct, let alone more than just remotely, I stop them. I say, that's against the Torah. Like forgetting about, oh, it's a desecration of God's name, which it also is in our society. But it's actually simply against the Torah. The Mishnah says that, right? Source number 5. Furthermore, man was created alone for the sake of peace among men, that one might not say to his fellow, my father was greater than yours. The Torah is teaching a very important value by saying that everybody is one family. We're really one family. So these are basic universalistic messages of what the Torah is trying to teach. Simultaneously, there is a particularistic side to our tradition, which is God gave the Torah to the people of Israel and has a unique covenantal relationship with us. We have something to give to the world that God gave through our people. And that we have a separate set of observances as a result of that. There are different things about the God-Israel relationship from all of humanity. There's nothing racist about that. Anybody who wishes can convert to Judaism. Right, part of our mission in our world, and certainly what our institute is about, is making sure that rabbis have a better sense of being open to sincere converts than much of the Jewish world is today, which is very disturbing on so many levels. But the bottom line is that our universalistic and particularistic elements are part and parcel of what the Torah is all about. So some Jews focus almost exclusively on the particularistic thing. Why we're Jews, and then it's us and them all over again. Disaster. Right? Then there are other Jews who focus on the universalistic side but forget about who we are. So they're focused on mission to humanity, but they simply lose that anchor of what's the Jewish mission to humanity, as opposed to just having good universal values. So one of our main goals is trying to teach this two half-truths make a truth again. The idea of the chosen people is a means of being able to convey universalistic and particularistic values all together. And I think that's what it's really all about. We've seen several areas today that I think are all critical, both in terms of how we teach our students, how we run as communities, and how we build a better society. Within the Orthodox world, we have to keep on teaching. Reverence for sages and openness to scholarship are not contradictory things. They're part and parcel of what our tradition always has been and what it always should be. Right? When it comes to relating to non-observant or less observant Jews, whether in belief or in practice, it has to do with love and teach the right way and keep on modeling the right way rather than any shunning, shutting out, creating separate communities, branding as heretics. When it comes to Jews and non-Jews, we're all part of one family, and that our messianic vision, which Mrs. Berger spoke about very eloquently, it's all about are getting our own act in order for the benefit of humankind. It's not, Mashiach is never just about why it's good for the Jews. It's good for the world. I remember once I was on a Shabbat table in Israel somewhere. So I like to talk about this topic. I'm very messianic in my own way. And I pointed out that our basic vision has to do with Jews and non-Jews. So somebody at the table said, oh, you actually believe in that approach? And I just responded, I'm like, according to the prophets, I don't think that I have a choice. I think that is our vision. I don't think that there are some prophets who think that it's all about Israel and other prophets who think it's Israel and the world. Our basic vision, going back to Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, have to do with our relationship with all of humanity. What it all comes down to is that it's always easier to espouse a half-truth than a whole truth, because a whole truth takes a lot of work. A half truth, you take 5 minutes and then you feel really good about it. One of our jobs at the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals is to promote a much more careful balance of the whole truth, hearing both sides that divide the community and create rifts, and help mend those rifts through our journal, through our website, through our ongoing programming, through our teacher training, and we hope to be doing this for a very long time. For those of you who are already members, great, you're doing something wonderful. If you're not already a member, for as little as $100 a year, you sign on, you become part of it. Every single one of my source sheets is always my business card. You can find our website, jewishideas.org. I hope that you will see what we are up to. And always feel free to be in touch. I'm so grateful that you all came out this morning, and we look forward to seeing you at future events. Thank you so much.